This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The World of Ice and Fire, The Untold History of Westeros and the Game of Thrones, by George R.R. Martin, Elio M. Garcia, Jr., and Linda Antonsen. Read for you by Roy Dotrice, with Nicholas Guy Smith.
To his most esteemed and gracious lord, Tommen, the first of his name, King of the Andals and the Rhoynar and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms and Protector of the Realm, Yandel, humble maester of the Citadel, wishes thousandfold prosperity, now and forever, and wisdom unmatched.
Preface. It is said with truth that every building is constructed stone by stone, and the same may be said of knowledge, extracted and compiled by many learned men, each of whom builds upon the works of those who preceded him. What one of them does not know is known to another, and little remains truly unknown if one seeks far enough. Now I, Maester Yendel, take my turn as mason, curving what I know to place one more stone in the great bastion of knowledge that has been built over the centuries, both within and without the confines of the citadel, a bastion raised by countless hands that came before, and which will, no doubt, continue to rise with the aid of countless hands yet to come. I was a foundling from my birth in the 10th year of the reign of the last Targaryen king, left on a morning in an empty stall in the scribe's hearth, where acolytes practiced the art of letters for those who had need. The course of my life was set that day, when I was found by an acolyte who took me to the seneschal of that year, Archmaester Edgeron. Edgeron, whose ring and rod and mask were silver, looked upon my squalling face and announced that I might prove of use. When first told this as a boy, I took it to mean he foresaw my destiny as a maester. Only much later did I come to learn from Archmaester Ebros that Edgeron was writing a treatise on the swaddling of infants and wished to test certain theories. But inauspicious as that may seem, the result was that I was given to the care of servants and received the occasional attention of maesters. I was raised as a servant myself amongst the halls and chambers and libraries, but I was given the gift of letters by Archmaester Walgrave. Thus did I come to know and love the citadel and the knights of the mind, who guarded its precious wisdom. I desired nothing more than to become one of them, to read of far places and long-dead men, to gaze at the stars and measure the passing of the seasons. And so I did. I forged the first link in my chain at 3 and 10, and other links followed. I completed my chain and took my oaths in the 9th year of the reign of King Robert, the first of his name, and found myself blessed to continue at the citadel to serve the archmaesters and aid them in all that they did. It was a great honour, but my greatest desire was to create a work of mine own, a work that humble but lettered men might read, and read to their wives and children, so that they would learn of things both good and wicked, just and unjust, great and small, and grow wiser as I had grown wiser amidst the learning of the citadel. And so I set myself to work once more at my forge, to make new and notable matter around the masterworks of the long-dead maesters who came before me. What follows herein sprang from that desire, a history of deeds gallant and wicked, peoples familiar and strange, and lands near and far. Ancient History. the Dawn Age. There are none who can say with certain knowledge when the world began. Yet this has not stopped many maesters and learned men from seeking the answer. Is it 40,000 years old, as some hold, or perhaps a number as large as 500,000, or even more? It is not written in any book that we know. For in the first age of the world, the Dawn Age, men were not lettered. We can be certain that the world was far more primitive, however, a barbarous place of tribes living directly from the land with no knowledge of the working of metal or the taming of beasts. What little is known to us of those days is contained in the oldest of texts, the tales written down by the Andals, by the Valyrians, and by the Gascari, and even by those distant people of fabled Ashai. Yet however ancient those lettered races, they were not even children during the Dawn Age. So what truths their tales contain are difficult to find, like seeds among chaff. What can most accurately be told about the Dawn Age? The eastern lands were awash with many peoples, uncivilized, as all the world was uncivilized, but numerous. But on Westeros, from the lands of always winter to the shores of the summer sea, only two peoples existed, the children of the forest and the race of creatures known as the giants. Of the giants in the Dawn Age, little and less can be said, for no one has gathered their tales, their legends, their histories. Men of the Watch say the wildlings have tales of the giants living uneasily alongside the children, ranging where they would and taking what they wanted. All the accounts claim that they were huge and powerful creatures, but simple. Reliable accounts from the rangers of the Night's Watch, who were the last men to see the giants while they still lived, state that they were covered in a thick fur, rather than simply being very large men, as the nursery tales hold. There is considerable evidence of burials among the giants, as recorded in Maester Kennet's Passages of the Dead, a study of the barrow fields and graves and tombs of the North in his time of service at Winterfell, during the long reign of Craegan Stark. From bones that have been found in the North and sent to the Citadel, some maesters estimate that the largest of the giants could reach 14 feet, though others say 12 feet is nearer the truth. The tales of long-dead rangers written down by maesters of the Watch all agree that the giants did not make homes or garments, and knew of no better tools or weapons than branches pulled from trees. The giants had no kings and no lords, made no homes, save in caverns or beneath tall trees, and they worked neither metal nor fields. They remained creatures of the Dawn Age, even as the ages passed them by. Men grew ever more numerous, and the forests were tamed and dwindled. Now the giants are gone even in the lands beyond the wall, and the last reports of them are more than 100 years old. And even those are dubious. Tales that rangers of the Watch might tell over a warm fire. The children of the forest were, in many ways, the opposites of the giants, as small as children, but dark and beautiful. They lived in a manner we might call crude today, yet they were still less barbarous than the giants. They worked no metal, but they had great art in working obsidian, what the small folk called dragon glass, while the Valyrians knew it by a word meaning frozen fire, to make tools and weapons for hunting. They wove no cloths, but were skilled in making garments of leaves and bark. They learned to make bows of weirwood and to construct flying snares of grass, and both of the sexes hunted with these. Their song and music were said to be as beautiful as they were, but what they sang of is not remembered, save in small fragments handed down from ancient days. Maester Chyler's Winter's Kings, or the legends and Lineages of the Starks of Winterfell, contains a part of a ballad alleged to tell of the time Brandon the Builder sought the aid of the children while raising the wall. He was taken to a secret place to meet with them, but could not at first understand their speech, which was described as sounding like the song of stones in a brook, or the wind through leaves, or the rain upon the water. The manner in which Brandon learned to comprehend the speech of the children is a tale in itself and not worth repeating here, but it seems clear that their speech originated, or drew inspiration from, the sounds they heard every day.
The archives of the Citadel contain a letter from Maester Aemon, sent in the early years of the reign of Aegon V, which reports on an account from a ranger named Redwyn, written in the days of King Dorran Stark. It recounts a journey to Lorne Point and the Frozen Shore, in which it is claimed that the ranger and his companions fought giants and traded with the children of the forest. Aemon's letter claimed that he had found many such accounts in his examinations of the archives of the Watch at Castle Black, and considered them credible.
The gods the children worshipped were the nameless ones that would one day become the gods of the first men, the innumerable gods of the streams and forests and stones. It was the children who carved the weirwoods with faces, perhaps to give eyes to their gods so that they might watch their worshippers at their devotions. Others, with little evidence, claimed that the green seers, the wise men of the children, were able to see through the eyes of the carved weirwoods. The supposed proof is the fact that the first men themselves believed this. It was their fear of the weirwoods spying upon them that drove them to cut down many of the carved trees and weirwood groves, to deny the children such an advantage. Yet the first men were less learned than we are now, and credited things that their descendants today do not. Consider Maester Yorick's Wed to the Sea, being an account of the history of White Harbour from its earliest days, which recounts the practice of blood sacrifice to the old gods. Such sacrifices persisted as recently as 5 centuries ago, according to accounts from Maester Yorick's predecessors at White Harbour. This is not to say that the green seers did not know lost arts that belong to the higher mysteries, such as seeing events at a great distance, or communicating across half a realm, as the Valyrians who came long after them did. But mayhap some of the feats of the green seers have more to do with foolish tales than truth. They could not change their forms into those of beasts, as some would have it. But it seems true that they were capable of communicating with animals in a way that we cannot now achieve. It is from this that legends of skin changers or beastlings arose. In truth, the legends of the skin changers are many, but the most common, brought from beyond the wall by men of the Night's Watch and recorded at the wall by septons and maesters of centuries past, hold that the skin changers not only communicated with beasts, but could control them by having their spirits mingle. Even among the wildlings, these skin changers were feared as unnatural men who could call on animals as allies. Some tales speak of skin changers losing themselves in their beasts, and others say that the animals could speak with a human voice when a skin changer controlled them. But all the tales agree that the most common skin changers were men who controlled wolves, even dire wolves, and these had a special name among the wildlings, wargs.
Though considered disreputable in this, our present day, a fragment of Septon Barth's Unnatural History has proved a source of controversy in the halls of the Citadel. Claiming to have consulted with texts said to be preserved at Castle Black, Septon-Bath put forth that the children of the forest could speak with ravens and could make them repeat their words. According to Bath, this higher mystery was taught to the first men by the children, so that ravens could spread messages at a great distance. It was passed, in degraded form, down to the maesters today, who no longer know how to speak to the birds. It is true that our order understands the speech of ravens, but this means the basic purposes of their cawing and rasping, their signs of fear and anger, and the means by which they display their readiness to mate or their lack of health. Ravens are amongst the cleverest of birds, but they are no wiser than infant children, and considerably less capable of true speech, whatever Septon Bath might have believed. A few maesters, devoted to the link of Valyrian steel, have argued that Bath was correct, but not a one has been able to prove his claims regarding speech between men and ravens.
Legend further holds that the Green Seers could also delve into the past and see far into the future. But as all our learning has shown us, the higher mysteries that claim this power also claim that their visions of the things to come are unclear and often misleading. A useful thing to say when seeking to fool the unwary with fortune-telling. Though the children had arts of their own, the truth must always be separated from superstition, and knowledge must be tested and made sure. The higher mysteries, the arts of magic, were and are beyond the boundaries of our mortal ability to examine. Yet no matter the truths of their arts, the children were led by their green seers, and there is no doubt that they could once be found from the lands of always winter to the shores of the summer sea. They made their home simply, constructing no holdfasts or castles or cities. Instead, they resided in the woods, in crannogs, in bogs and marshes, and even in caverns and hollow hills. It is said that in the woods they made shelters of leaves and withes up in the branches of trees, secret tree towns. It has long been held that they did this for protection from predators, such as direwolves or shadow cats, which their simple stone weapons and even their vaunted green seers were not proof against. But other sources dispute this, stating that their greatest foes were the giants, as hinted at in tales told in the north, and as possibly proved by Maester Kennet in the study of a barrow near the Long Lake, a giant's burial with obsidian arrowheads found amidst the extant ribs. It brings to mind a transcription of a wildling song in Maester Herrick's History of the Kings, Beyond the Wall, regarding the brothers Gendel and Gorn. They were called upon to mediate a dispute between a clan of children and a family of giants over the possession of a cavern. Gendel and Gorn, it is said, ultimately resolved the matter through trickery, making both sides disavow any desire for the cavern, after the brothers discovered it was a part of a greater chain of caverns that eventually passed beneath the wall. But considering that the wildlings have no letters, their traditions must be looked at with a jaundiced eye. The beasts of the woods and the giants were eventually joined by other, greater dangers, however.
A possibility arises for a third race to have inhabited the Seven Kingdoms in the Dawn Age, but it is so speculative that it need only be dealt with briefly. Among the Ironborn, it is said that the first of the first men to come to the Iron Isles found the famous Seastone Chair on Old Wick, but that the isles were uninhabited. If true, the nature and origins of the chair's makers are a mystery. Maester Kurth, in his collection of Ironborn legends, Songs the Drowned Men Sing, has suggested that the chair was left by visitors from across the Sunset Sea. But there is no evidence for this, only speculation.
The coming of the first men. According to the most well-regarded accounts from the Citadel, anywhere from 8,000 to 12,000 years ago, in the southernmost reaches of Westeros, a new people crossed the strip of land that bridged the narrow sea and connected the Easter lands with the land in which the children and giants lived. It was here that the first men came into Dorne via the broken arm, which was not yet broken. Why these people left their homelands is lost to all knowing. But when they came in force. Thousands entered and began to settle the lands, and as the decades passed, they pushed farther and farther north. Such tales as we have of those migratory days are not to be trusted, for they suggest that within a few short years the first men had moved beyond the Neck and into the north. Yet in truth, it would have taken decades, even centuries, for this to occur. What does seem to be accurate from all the tales, however, is that the first men soon came to war with the children of the forest. Unlike the children, the first men farmed the land and raised up ring forts and villages, and in so doing, they took to chopping down the weirwood trees, including those with carved faces, and for this, the children attacked them, leading to hundreds of years of war. The first men, who had brought with them strange gods, horses, cattle, and weapons of bronze, were also larger and stronger than the children, and so they were a significant threat. The hunters among the children, their wood dancers, became their warriors as well. But for all their secret arts of tree and leaf, they could only slow the first men in their advance. The green seers employed their arts, and tales say they could call the beasts of marsh, forest, and air to fight on their behalf. Direwolves and monstrous snow bears, cave lions and eagles, mammoths and serpents, and more. But the first men proved too powerful, and the children are said to have been driven to a desperate act. Legend says that the great floods that broke the land bridge that is now the broken arm and made the Neck a swamp were the work of the Green Seers, who gathered at Moat Cailin to work dark magic. Some contest this, however. The first men were already in Westeros when this occurred, and stemming the tide from the east would do little more than slow their progress. Moreover, such power is beyond even what the Green Seers are traditionally said to have been capable of, and even those accounts appear exaggerated. It is likelier that the inundation of the Neck and the breaking of the arm were natural events, possibly caused by a natural sinking of the land. What became of Valyria is well known, and in the Iron Islands, the Castle of Pyke sits on stacks of stone that were once part of the greater island before segments of it crumbled into the sea. Regardless, the children of the forest fought as fiercely as the first men to defend their lives. Inexorably, the war ground on across generations, until at last the children understood that they could not win. The first men, perhaps tired of war, also wished to see an end to the fighting. The wisest of both races prevailed, and the chief heroes and rulers of both sides met upon the isle in the God's Eye to form the pact, giving up all the lands of Westeros, save for the deep forests. The children won from the first men the promise that they would no longer cut down the weirwoods. All the weirwoods of the isle on which the pact was forged were then carved with faces so that the gods could witness the pact, and the Order of Green Men was made afterward to tend to the weirwoods and protect the isle. With the pact, the Dawn Age of the world drew to a close, and the Age of Heroes followed.
Whether the Green Men still survive on their isle is not clear, although there is the occasional account of some foolhardy young river lord taking a boat to the isle,
and catching sight of them before winds rise up, or a flock of ravens drives him away. The nursery tales, claiming that they are horned and have dark green skin, is a corruption of the likely truth, which is that the green men wore green garments and horned headdresses.
The Age of Heroes. The Age of Heroes lasted for thousands of years, in which kingdoms rose and fell, noble houses were founded and withered away, and great deeds were accomplished. Yet what we truly know of those ancient days is hardly more than what we know of the Dawn Age. The tales we have now are the work of septons and maesters, writing thousands of years after the fact. Yet unlike the children of the forest and the giants, the first men of this age of heroes left behind some ruins and ancient castles that can corroborate parts of the legends. And there are stone monuments in the barrow fields and elsewhere marked with their runes. It is through these remnants that we can begin to ferret out the truth behind the tales. What is commonly accepted is that the Age of Heroes began with a pact and extended through the thousands of years in which the first men and the children lived in peace with one another. With so much land ceded to them, the first men at last had room to increase. From the land of always winter to the shores of the summer sea, the first men ruled from their ring forts. Petty kings and powerful lords proliferated, but in time some few proved to be stronger than the rest, forging the seeds of the kingdoms that are the ancestors of the seven kingdoms we know today. The names of the kings of these earliest realms are caught up in legend, and the tales that claim their individual rules lasted hundreds of years are to be understood as errors and fantasies introduced by others in later days. Names such as Brandon the Builder, Garth Greenhand, Lan the Clever, and Durin Godsgreef are names to conjure with, but it is likely that their legends hold less truth than fancy. Elsewhere I shall endeavour to sift what grain can be found from the chaff, but for now it is enough to acknowledge the tales. And besides the legendary kings and hundreds of kingdoms from which the seven kingdoms were born, stories of such as Simeon Star Eyes, Serwyn of the Mirror Shield, and other heroes have become fodder for septons and singers alike. Did such heroes once exist? It may be so, but when the singers number Serwyn of the Mirror Shield as one of the King's Guard, an institution that was only formed during the reign of Aegon the Conqueror, we can see why it is that few of these tales can ever be trusted. The septons, who first wrote them down, took what details suited them and added others, and the singers changed them, sometimes beyond all recognition, for the sake of a warm place in some lord's hall. In such a way does some long-dead first man become a knight who follows the Seven and guards the Targaryen kings thousands of years after he lived, if he ever did. The legion of boys and youths made ignorant of the past history of Westeros by these foolish tales cannot be numbered.
It is best to remember that when we speak of these legendary founders of realms, we speak merely of some early domains, generally centered on a high seat, such as Casterly Rock or Winterfell, that in time incorporated more and more land and power into their grasp. If Garth Greenhand ever ruled what he claimed was the Kingdom of the Reach, it is doubtful its writ was anything more than notional, beyond a fortnight's ride from his halls. But from such petty domains arose the mightier kingdoms that came to dominate Westeros in the millennia to come.
The Long Night. As the first men established their realms following the pact, little troubled them save their own feuds and wars, or so the histories tell us. It is also from these histories that we learn of the long night, when a season of winter came that lasted a generation. A generation in which children were born, grew into adulthood, and in many cases died, without ever seeing the spring. Indeed, some of the old wives' tales say that they never even beheld the light of day, so complete was the winter that fell on the world. While this last may well be no more than fancy, the fact that some cataclysm took place many thousands of years ago seems certain. Lomas Longstrider, in his Wonders Made by Man, recounts meeting descendants of the Roynar in the ruins of the festival city of Croyen, who have tales of a darkness that made the Roynar dwindle and disappear, her waters frozen as far south as the joining of the Selhoru. According to these tales, the return of the sun came only when a hero convinced Mother Royan's many children, lesser gods such as the Crab King and the Old Man of the River, to put aside their bickering and join together to sing a secret song that brought back the day. It is also written that there are annals in Ashai of such a darkness, and of a hero who fought against it with a red sword. His deeds are said to have been performed before the rise of Valyria, in the earliest age when old Gis was first forming its empire. This legend has spread west from Ashai, and the followers of R'hllor claim that this hero was named Azor Ahai, and prophesy his return. In the Jade Compendium, Colloquo Votar recounts a curious legend from Yi Ti, which states that the sun hid its face from the earth for a lifetime, ashamed at something none could discover, and that disaster was averted only by the deeds of a woman with a monkey's tail. However, if this fell winter did take place, as the tales say, the privation would have been terrible to behold. During the hardest winters, it is customary for the eldest and most infirm amongst the Northmen to claim they are going out hunting, knowing full well they will never return, and thus leaving a little more food for those likelier to survive. Doubtless this practice was common during the long night. Yet there are other tales, harder to credit, and yet more central to the old histories, about creatures known as the Others. According to these tales, they came from the frozen land of always winter, bringing the cold and darkness with them as they sought to extinguish all light and warmth. The tales go on to say they rode monstrous ice spiders and the horses of the dead, resurrected to serve them just as they resurrected dead men to fight on their behalf.
Though the Citadel has long sought to learn the manner by which it may predict the length and change of seasons, all efforts have been confounded. Septon Barth appear to argue, in a fragmentary treatise, that the inconstancy of the seasons was a matter of magical art rather than trustworthy knowledge. Maester Nichols' The Measure of the Days, otherwise a laudable work containing much of use, seems influenced by this argument. Based upon his work on the movement of stars in the firmament, Nichol argues unconvincingly that the seasons might once have been of a regular length, determined solely by the way in which the globe faces the sun in its heavenly course. The notion behind it seems true enough, that the lengthening and shortening of days, if more regular, would have led to more regular seasons. But he could find no evidence that such was ever the case, beyond the most ancient of tales.
How the long night came to an end is a matter of legend, as all such matters of the distant past have become. In the north, they tell of a last hero who sought out the intercession of the children of the forest, his companions abandoning him or dying one by one as they faced ravenous giants, cold servants, and the others themselves. Alone, he finally reached the children, despite the efforts of the White Walkers, and all the tales agree this was a turning point. Thanks to the children, the first men of the Night's Watch banded together and were able to fight and win the battle for the dawn, the last battle that broke the endless winter and sent the others fleeing to the icy north. Now, 6,000 years later, or 8,000, as true history puts forward, the wall made to defend the realms of men is still manned by the sworn brothers of the Night's Watch, and neither the others nor the children have been seen in many centuries.
Archmaester Fomus's Lies of the Ancients, though little regarded these days for its erroneous claims regarding the founding of Valyria and certain lineal claims in the Reach and Westerlands, does speculate that the others of legend were nothing more than a tribe of the First Men, ancestors of the Wildlings, that had established itself in the far north. Because of the long night, these early Wildlings were then pressured to begin a wave of conquest to the south. That they became monstrous in the tales told thereafter, according to Fomus, reflects the desire of the Night's Watch and the Starks to give themselves a more heroic identity as saviors of mankind, and not merely the beneficiaries of a struggle over dominion.
The Rise of Valyria. As Westeros recovered from the long night, a new power was rising in Essos. The vast continent stretching from the Narrow Sea to the fabled Jade Sea and faraway Althus seems to be the place where civilization, as we know it, developed. The first of these, notwithstanding the dubious claims of Karth, the Yeetish legends of the Great Empire of the Dawn, and the difficulties of finding any truth in the tales of legendary Ashai, was rooted in Ol'Gis, a city built upon slavery. The legendary founder of the city, Grasdan the Great, remains so revered that men of the slaver families are still often given his name. It was he who, according to the oldest histories of the Geskari, founded the Lockstep Legions, with their tall shields and three spears, which were the first to fight as disciplined bodies. Ol'Gis and its army proceeded to colonize its surroundings, then pressing on to subjugate its neighbors. Thus was the first empire born, and for centuries it reigned supreme. It was on the great peninsula across from Slaver's Bay that those who brought an end to the empire of Ol'Gis, though not to all of their ways, originated. Sheltered there amidst the great volcanic mountains known as the 14 Flames were the Valyrians, who learned to tame dragons and make them the most fearsome weapon of war that the world ever saw. The tales the Valyrians told of themselves claimed they were descended from dragons and were kin to the ones they now controlled. The great beauty of the Valyrians were their hair of palest silver or gold, and eyes in shades of purple, not found amongst any other peoples of the world, is well known, and often held up as proof that the Valyrians are not entirely of the same blood as other men. Yet there are maesters who point out that, by careful breeding of animals, one can achieve a desirable result, and that populations in isolation can often show quite remarkable variations from what might be regarded as common. This may be a likelier answer to the mystery of the Valyrian origins, although it does not explain the affinity with dragons that those with the blood of Valyria clearly had. The Valyrians had no kings, but instead called themselves the Freehold, because all the citizenry who held land had a voice. Archons might be chosen to help lead, but they were elected by the Lord's Freeholder from amongst their number, and only for a limited time. It was rare for Valyria to be swayed by one freeholding family alone, although it was not entirely unknown either. the five great wars between the Freehold and Old Gis, when the world was young, are the stuff of legend. Conflagrations that ended each time in the victory of the Valyrians over the Gascari. It was during the fifth and final war that the Freehold chose to make sure there would be no sixth war. The ancient brick walls of Old Gis, first erected by Grasdan the Great in ancient days, were razed.
In such fragments of Barth's unnatural history as remain, the Septon appears to have considered various legends examining the origins of dragons and how they came to be controlled by the Valyrians. The Valyrians themselves claimed that dragons sprang forth as the children of the 14 flames, while in Carth, the tales state that there was once a second moon in the sky. One day this moon was scalded by the sun and cracked like an egg, and a million dragons poured forth. In Ash Eye, the tales are many and confused, but certain texts, all impossibly ancient, claim that dragons first came from the Shadow, a place where all of our learning fails us. These Ash Eye histories say that a people so ancient they had no name first tamed dragons in the Shadow and brought them to Valyria, teaching the Valyrians their arts before departing from the annals. Yet, if men in the Shadow had tamed dragons first, why did they not conquer as the Valyrians did? It seems likelier that the Valyrian tale is the truest. But there were dragons in Westeros, once, long before the Targaryens came, as our own legends and histories tell us. If dragons did first spring from the 14 flames, they must have been spread across much of the known world before they were tamed. And, in fact, there is evidence for this, as dragon bones have been found as far north as Ib, and even in the jungles of Sothorios. But the Valyrians harnessed and subjugated them as no one else could. What now remains of the once proud empire of Old Gis is a paltry thing, a few cities clinging like sores to Slaver's Bay, and another that pretends to be Old Gis come again. For after the doom came to Valyria, the cities of Slaver's Bay were able to throw off the last of the Valyrian shackles, ruling themselves in truth rather than playing at it. And what remained of the Giscari swiftly re-established their trade in slaves, though where once they won them by conquest, now they purchased and bred them. Bricks and blood built Astapor, and bricks and blood her people, an old rhyme says, referring to the red brick walls of the city and of the blood shed by the thousands of slaves who would live, labor, and die constructing them. Ruled by men who name themselves the Good Masters, Astapor is best known for the creation of the eunuch slave soldiers called the Unsullied, men raised from boyhood to be fearless warriors who feel no pain. The Astapori pretend that they are the lockstep legions of the old empire come again. But those men were free, and the Unsullied are not. Of Yunkai, the Yellow City, little needs to be said, for it is a most disreputable place. The men who rule it, calling themselves the Wise Masters, are steeped in corruption, selling bed-slaves and boy-whores, and worse. The most formidable of the cities along Slaver's Bay is Ancient Marine, but like the rest, it is a crumbling place, its population a fraction of what it once supported at the height of the old empire. Its walls of many colored bricks contain endless suffering, for the great masters of Marine train slaves to fight and die at their pleasure in the blood-soaked fighting pit. All three cities have been known to pay tribute to passing Khalasars, rather than face them in open battle, but the Dothraki provide many of the slaves that the Giscari train and sell, slaves taken from their conquests and sold in the flesh markets of Marine, Yunkai, and Astapor. The most vital of the Giscari cities is also the smallest and the newest, and no less a pretender to greatness. New Gis, left to its own devices on its isle. There, its masters have formed iron legions in mimicry of the legions of the old empire. But unlike the Unsullied, these are free men, as the soldiers of the old empire were.
The colossal pyramids and temples and homes were given over to dragon flame. The fields were sown with salt, lime, and skulls. Many of the Giscari were slain, and still others were enslaved and died laboring for their conquerors. Thus the Giscari became but another part of the new Valyrian Empire, and in time they forgot the tongue that Greslin spoke, learning instead High Valyrian. So do empires end, and others arise. Valyria's Children. The Valyrians learn one deplorable thing from the Giscari slavery. The Giscari, whom they conquered, were the first to be thus enslaved, but not the last. The burning mountains of the 14 Flames were rich with ore, and the Valyrians hungered for it. Copper and tin for the bronze of their weapons and monuments, later iron for the steel of their legendary blades, and always gold and silver to pay for it all.
The properties of Valyrian steel are well known, and are the result of both folding iron many times to balance and remove impurities, and the use of spells, or at least arts we do not know, to give unnatural strength to the resulting steel. Those arts are now lost, though the smiths of Kohor claim to still know magics for reworking Valyrian steel without losing its strength or unsurpassed ability to hold an edge. The Valyrian steel blades that remain in the world might number in the thousands, but in the Seven Kingdoms there are only 227 such weapons, according to Archmaester Thurgood's inventories, some of which have since been lost or have disappeared from the annals of history.
None can say how many perished, toiling, in the Valyrian mines, but the number was so large as to surely defy comprehension. As Valyria grew, its need for ore increased, which led to ever more conquest to keep the mines stocked with slaves. The Valyrians expanded in all directions, stretching out east beyond the Giscari cities and west to the very shores of Essos, where even the Giscari had not made inroads. It was this first bursting forth of the new empire that was of paramount importance to Westeros and the future Seven Kingdoms. As Valyria sought to conquer more and more lands and peoples, some fled for safety, retreating before the Valyrian tide. On the shores of Essos, the Valyrians raised cities which we know today as the Free Cities. Their origins were diverse. Kohor and Norvos were founded following religious schisms. Others, such as Old Volantis and Lys, were trading colonies first and foremost, founded by wealthy merchants and nobles who purchased the right to rule themselves as clients of the freehold rather than subjects. These cities chose their own leaders rather than receiving archons dispatched from Valyria, often on dragonback, to oversee them. It is claimed in some histories that Pentos and Loreth were of a third type, cities already extant before the Valyrians came, whose rulers paid homage to Valyria and thus retained their right to native rule. In these cities, what influx of Valyrian blood there was came from migrants from the freehold, or political marriages used to better bind these cities to Valyria. Yet most of the histories that recount this take as their source Jessir Horatus's Before the Dragons. Horatus was himself from Pentos, and at the time Valentus was threatening to restore the Valerian Empire under its control. So the notion of an independent Pentos, with origins distinct from Valeria, was a most politic convenience. However, it is clear that Bravus is unique among all the free cities, as it was founded not by the will of the freehold, nor by its citizens, but instead by its slaves. According to the tales of the Bravassi, a huge slaver fleet that had been out collecting tributes in human flesh from the lands of the summer and jade seas became victim to a slave uprising instead. The success of this uprising was doubtless dependent on the fact that the Valerians were wont to use slaves as oarsmen and even sailors, and that these men then joined the uprising. Seizing control of the fleet but realizing there was no place nearby to hide from the freehold, the slaves instead elected to seek out some land far from Valeria and its subjects, and founded their own city in hiding. Legend says that the Moonsingers prophesied that the fleet must travel far north to a forlorn corner of Essos, a place of mudflats and brackish water and fogs. There the slaves first laid the foundation of their city. For centuries, the Bravassi remained hidden from the world in their remote lagoon. And even after it unveiled itself, Bravus continued to be known as the secret city. The Bravassi were a people who were no people. Scores of races, 100 tongues, and hundreds of gods. All they had in common was the Valerian that formed the common trade language of Essos, and the fact that they were now free where once they had been slaves. The Moonsingers were honored for leading them to their city, but the wisest among the freed slaves determined that to unify themselves they must accept all the gods the slaves had brought with them, holding none higher than any other. In short, the names and numbers of the peoples who fell to Valeria are unknown to us today. What records the Valerians kept of their conquests were largely destroyed by the doom. And few, if any, of these peoples documented their own histories in a way that survived the freehold's dominion. A few, such as the Rhoynar, lasted against the tide for centuries, or even millennia. The Rhoynar, who founded great cities along the Rhoyne, were said to be the first to learn the art of iron-making. Also, the Confederation of Cities, later called the Kingdom of Sarno, survived the Valerian expansion thanks to the great plain that separated one from the other. Only for that plain and the people who occupied it, the Dothraki horse lords, to be the source of Sarno's downfall after the doom. And those who would not be slaves, but were unable to withstand the might of Valeria, fled. Many failed and are forgotten. But one people, tall and fair-haired, made courageous and indomitable by their faith, succeeded in their escape from Valeria, and those men are the Andals.
Of the history of Valeria, as it is known today, many volumes have been written over the centuries, and the details of their conquests, their colonizations, the feuds of the dragon lords, the gods they worshipped, and more could fill libraries and still not be complete. Galendro's The Fires of the Freehold is widely considered the most definitive history, and even there the Citadel lacks 27 of the scrolls.
The Arrival of the Andals. The Andals originated in the lands of the Axe, east and north of where Pentos now lies. Though they were for many centuries a migratory people who did not remain in one place for long. From the heartlands of the Axe, a great spur of land surrounded on all sides by the Shivering Sea, they travel south and west to carve out Andalus, the ancient realm the Andals ruled before they crossed the narrow sea. Andalus stretched from the Axe to what is now the Vervossian coastlands, and south as far as the Flatlands and the Velvet Hills. The Andals brought iron weapons with them, and suits of iron plates, against which the tribes that inhabited those lands could do little. One such tribe was the Hairy Men. Their name is lost, but they are still remembered in certain Pentoshi histories. The Pentoshi believe them to be akin to the men of Ib, and the histories of the citadel largely agree, though some argue that the Hairy Men settled Ib, and others that the Hairy Men came first from Ib. The fact that the Andals forged iron has been taken by some as proof that the Seven guided them, that the smith himself taught them this art. And so do the holy texts teach. But the Rhoynar were already an advanced civilization at this time, and they too knew of iron, so it takes only the study of a map to realize that the earliest Andals must have had contact with the Rhoynar. The Dark Wash and the Noyne lay directly in the path of the Andals' migration, and there are remnants of Rhoynish outposts in Andalus. According to the Norvosche historian Doro Galathus, and it would not be the first time that men learned of the working of iron from the Rhoynar. It is said that the Valyrians learned the art from them as well, although the Valyrians eventually surpassed them. For thousands of years the Andals abided in Andalus, growing in number. In the oldest of the holy books, the Seven-Pointed Star, it is said that the Seven themselves walked among their people in the hills of Andalus. And it was they who crowned Hugo of the Hill and promised him and his descendants great kingdoms in a foreign land. This is what the Septons and Septars teach as a reason why the Andals left Essos and struck west to Westeros. But the history that the Citadel has uncovered over the centuries may provide a better reason.
An old legend told in Pentos claims that the Andals slew the Swan Maidens who lured travelers to their deaths in the Velvet Hills that lie to the east of the Free City. A hero whom the Pentoshi singers call Huko led the Andals at that time, and it is said that he slew the Seven Maids not for their crimes, but instead as sacrifice to his gods. There are some maesters who have noted that Huko may well be a rendering of the name of Hugor, but even more so than in the Seven Kingdoms, ancient legends from the East must be distrusted. Too many peoples have travelled back and forth, and too many legends and tales have mingled.
For a few centuries, as the Andals prospered in the hills of Andalus, they were left more or less to themselves. But with the fall of Old Gis came the great surge of conquests and colonization from the freehold of Valyria, as they expanded their domains and sought more slaves. At first, the Rhoyne and the Rhoynar served as a buffer. By the time the Valyrians reached that great river, they found it difficult to make a crossing in force. The dragon lords might not be troubled, but the foot and horsemen found it daunting in the face of Rhoynish resistance, given that the Rhoynish were by now as powerful as Gis at its height. There was a truce for years between the Valyrians and the Rhoynar, but it only protected the Andals so far. At the mouth of the Rhoyne, the Valyrians founded the first of their colonies. There Valantus was raised by some of the wealthiest men of the freehold in order to gather up the wealth that flowed down the Rhoyne, and from Valantus their conquering forces crossed the river in great strength. The Andals might have fought against them at first, and the Rhoynar might even have aided them, but the tide was unstoppable. So it is likely the Andals chose to flee rather than face the inevitable slavery that came with Valyrian conquest. They retreated to the Axe, the lands from which they had sprung, and when that did not protect them, they retreated farther north and west, until they came to the sea. Some might have given up there and surrendered to their fate, and others still might have made their last stand, but many and more made ships and sailed in great numbers across the narrow sea.